Cutting and bundling the feed was hot, dry, dusty work. The chaff got into Huey's shirt despite his buttoned collar and sleeves, and it itched like a rough wool coat on a sunburn. It was the type of work he would normally have ridden 100 miles on a lame horse to avoid. But he gloried in this because it marked the end of his captivity, the payment of his debt. An added pleasure, like a side bet, was that he'd be able to kick Fat Gervin in the butt with his own boot.
Yep.
Listening to their uncle sing as he worked, the boys agreed he'd gotten kicked in the head by a bronc without their knowledge. The black dog, lying at the turn row and watching for rabbits to flush ahead of the binder, raised his head and turned to stare at something. He got to his feet and went trotting off, wagging his tail. Huey's curious gaze moved past the dog and picked up an approaching buggy.
God almighty! Damn!
The gray horses and the buggy belonged to C.C. Tarpley and Fat Gervin. Fat was driving.
Whoa now! Whoa, easy.
Easing the binder team on up to the turn row, Huey assumed the second man would be C.C. But as he stepped down from the binder and wiped the gritty sweat from his face onto his sleeve and then onto a kerchief, he noticed a dun horse tied behind the buggy. Huey blinked his chaff-burned eyes and stared at the second man. He combed his memory, and suddenly his breath went short. The marshal from New Prosperity. Fat Gervin reined up and looked a moment at Huey. He turned to his passenger.
Marshal? Is that your man?
The marshal held a pistol in his hand. It was pointed at Huey.
That, sir, is sure as hell him. Hugh Holloway, I arrest you in the name of the law.
The breeze was light, but it worked through Huey's sweaty shirt. He felt a chill.
The name is Calloway.
Huey stared into the muzzle of the pistol. It looked as big as a cannon in a courthouse yard.
You raise those hands, Holloway.
If I turn loose of these lines, this green team is apt to take fright and run over all of us.
Cotton and Tommy watched wide-eyed. Huey motioned for Cotton to come up and take the reins.
I'd watch that man closely, Marshal. He's a slippery character.
Fat Gervin, I hope when you get home that your old mother comes running up to you on all fours and bites you on the leg.
Uncle Huey, what's this about? What does that man want with you?
Your brother can tell you.
I've just about given up on you, Holloway. I wrote letters to sheriffs all over the country. Not a one of them answered me. But your kind always floats to the surface like a dead fish. You want to know how I caught up with you?
Staring at that pistol and feeling that chill, Huey didn't much give a damn. But the marshal told him anyway.
Last week, our paper picked up an old item that had been printed in San Angelo. The name wasn't quite the same. But a little bird lit on my shoulder and whispered in my ear. So I come to Upton City. Sheriff here wasn't no help. He swore he'd never heard of no Holloway. Left me feeling kinda low. But I went to the bank to get me some traveling funds and happened to mention my trouble to Mr. Gervin. Now, he's a good law-abiding citizen, Mr. Gervin is. He knew right away who I was after. So here I am, Hugh Holloway. And justice is fixing to be done.
Huey and the boys all glared at Fat Gervin.
I've always tried to do my civic duty.
I never done anything to you, Marshal. Or at least nothing to justify you taking all this trouble.
You ignored an order from an officer of the law. And you attacked that officer in the carrying out of his legal duties. Let one man get away with such as that, and you open the door for all kinds of dangerous elements to come in and take over the country.
I ain't no dangerous element.
Any man who disrespects the power of the law is a dangerous element.
Huey turned his head and surveyed the field. It wouldn't take long to finish the cutting.
I got a job of work to finish here. If you'll let me do that, I'll go along with you real peaceable.
As he expected, the marshal vigorously shook his head.
I've been looking for you ever since last spring. I finally got you, and you're going back with me, right now.
Huey looked at first one of the boys, then the other.
It's up to you two, then, to finish here. You know what you gotta do.
I don't know if we can do it without you, Uncle Huey.
You can, and you've got to, for your mama and daddy.
Cotton's lips were tight. Tears came to Tommy's eyes. Huey couldn't look at the boys anymore. His eyes burned, and not just from the chaff. He turned back to the marshal.
I need to go down to the house first and speak to my folks.
And have them help you escape? No, sir. You're coming with me. We're leaving from right here.
My horse is down at the house, too.
You can take one of those out of harness.
These don't belong to me. They belong to Alvin Laudermilk.
The marshal clearly didn't believe him.
They'll do.
I'll still need my saddle.
You can ride bareback. By the time this trip is over with, you'll be more impressed with the majesty of the law.
He fished a set of handcuffs out of his pocket.
Will you please put these on him, Mr. Gervin? I'll keep him covered so he won't try anything.
Well, the pleasure will be all mine.
It damn sure will.
Huey had had a few minor run-ins with the authorities in his time, but never had steel cuffs been snapped shut around his wrists before. Their embrace was cold. He felt that chill again. He was sorry the boys had to be here to watch this. He felt humiliated, demeaned. But he brought himself to look back at them.
It's up to you boys to keep on. Finish the job like I was here.
We'll do our best.
Cotton's doubt was painfully clear. Huey wanted to hug the boys, but he couldn't, not with those cuffs on. His throat went tight again, and he turned away from them. Huey chose the horse he thought might be the easiest to ride, and he started unhitching him from the binder. The handcuffs made it difficult. Cotton moved to help him. The marshal swung the pistol toward the youngster.
Boy, you stand back from him.
Cold fear struck Huey.
Marshal, don't you point that gun at the kid.
Huey stepped back away from the horse, away from Cotton.
If you gotta point it at somebody, point it at me.
The marshal seemed to realize what he had done. He let the muzzle dip for a moment, then brought it back to bear on Huey. Cotton swallowed hard. His face had paled.
If it's any comfort to you, Uncle Huey, I know now that you and Wes Wheeler were right.
It is a comfort, Cotton.
When Huey mounted the plow horse bareback and Fat Gervin was satisfied that everything was proceeding according to his pleasure, he turned to the marshal.
Farewell, Marshal. It has been my pleasure to be of service to the law.
Fat turned the buggy around. He set the team of grays into a good trot and departed. The black dog followed after Gervin away, wagging its tail, hating to see him go. Huey watched him, wondering if Fat knew anything about Blue Hannigan's wagons. He was glad they hadn't arrived yet, for if Fat had seen them, he might have been able to figure things out for himself. The dog came back in time to bark at Huey as he rode off in a northeasterly direction with the marshal, leaving the desolate boys to stand and watch.
I looked the son of a bitch in the eye. Told him his lawless days were
over. They rode across country a while, Huey's head down as he darkly pondered the misfortunes he had brought upon himself and others. The marshal talked incessantly, mostly about other desperate criminals he'd managed to bring to justice. Try as they might, they had never been able to escape the long arm and longer memory of the law at New Prosperity. Listening to him, Huey wondered why the state hadn't disbanded the Texas Rangers and saved itself a lot of money. The marshal of New Prosperity could have handled the whole job by himself. They came eventually to a barbed wire fence. Nowhere up or down as far as they could see along the length of it was there a gate.
This is Alvin Laudermilk's. If we follow along a ways, we'll find a drop gap tied with wires instead of fastened with steeples.
The marshal contemplated him in dark suspicion.
We'll cross right here.
Alvin's kind of narrow-minded about people messing with his fences. We'd better find where he's made a place to cross.
Suddenly the pistol was back in the marshal's hand.
I'm the law and I can do what I goddamn please.
Huey feared the man might get overwrought and accidentally squeeze the trigger. There were no witnesses. He could tell any story he wanted to.
I sure wished you'd point that thing off to the side a little.
You pull the steeples out of that post.
I've got no pliers.
You've got a pocket knife, haven't you? Use that.
Huey poked around and broke a blade out of his good Barlow that he'd bought one time in Miles City, Montana. But he managed to worry the steeples out. The wires were fairly tight, but the posts were far enough apart that he was able to put his weight on the barbed wires and push them down to the ground level with his foot. He led the plow horse across, then looked up expectantly at the marshal. The marshal's dun must have had some bad experience with wire at one time or another. The lawman made two tries, both unsuccessful. Each time, he circled the horse out a little way and came back, never taking his eyes or the pistol off of Huey. The third time, the horse shied a little, then nervously picked one forefoot up high and stepped across the wires that Huey held stretched. He picked up the other forefoot and brought it over, trembling. For a moment, he stood that way, half on one side, half on the other, fearful about bringing his hind feet across.
Damn beast!
The horse faltered, and for a moment, the marshal let the pistol point upward. On impulse, Huey let go of the wires. They sprang up, the top one catching the dun horse just a little past mid-paunch. The surprised marshal let the pistol fly and grabbed the saddle horn with both hands. The second jump brought the dun clear of the fence and also clear of the marshal. There was only one small clump of prickly pear within 50 feet, and the marshal slammed down on his back squarely in the center of it. He lay there, rigid, the breath knocked out of him, his startled eyes staring straight up into the sun. Huey saw a badger hole dug beside a fence post. He picked up the fallen pistol, dropped it in, and caved off the edge of the hole with his boot. The marshal lay groaning and rolling his eyes, seeing little or nothing, struggling for breath, impaled on the mushy green but hostile round pads of the prickly pear. The dun had stopped pitching and stood looking back, trembling in the aftermath of panic. The saddle was half-turned, resting on the horse's right side. Huey mounted the plow horse and rode to the dun.
Whoa, ain't nothing gonna hurt you now.
He caught the trailing reins, got down, and lifted the saddle back into its proper position, then led the horse to the marshal. By now, the man had partially recovered his breath. He lay staring at Huey in terror, sure Huey was going to murder him in cold blood. Huey looked the dun horse over carefully for cuts. He found none of any account. He turned to the stricken marshal.
You're awful lucky. This horse ain't hurt a bit, hardly.
The marshal didn't dare move.
I think my back is broken. I got a pain in 1,000 places.
The prickly pear had cushioned his fall. Huey knew the pain was not caused by broken bones, but a broken back was much more dignified than a butt full of thorns. If the marshal preferred the importance of a catastrophic injury, who was Huey to deprive him?
You do look like you're in a bad way. If I was you, I wouldn't move a muscle. I'll ride over to Laudermilk's and send help.
For the first time, the marshal realized Huey wouldn't kill him.
You wouldn't leave me here.
You might die if I don't get somebody here who knows what to do. Don't you worry. There's some good ladies over at that house who'll take care of you. And don't you worry about me either. I'm going to finish up that job I was working on, and then I'll come back and turn myself over to you. That's a promise.
Losing his prisoner seemed a mild concern to the marshal at the moment.
Till Alvin comes with the wagon, you'd better lay real still. Try to be comfortable.
Come on, boys. We gotta get this feed loaded before dark and get it out of sight.
Huey got out of the cuffs, ground-tied the dun horse, and set out on the plow horse toward Alvin Laudermilk's. When he finally got back to the field, he saw that the boys had finished the cutting. Blue Hannigan's freight wagons were there, the men starting to load the bundle feed. The boys came running, both threw their arms around him.
Uncle Huey! How did you get away?
I didn't. Marshall just decided to take himself a rest before we start all the way back to New Prosperity.
Huey and the boys worked with the freighters until dusk, loading the itchy, dusty feed until they were exhausted, and until they knew it was time to get home and do up the chores before dark. The teamsters camped where they were so they could resume loading the rest of the feed at daylight. By the time the sun was up, Huey and the boys gathered the sale yearlings he'd been putting into the milk cow pasture. They tried to push them through the wire gate nearest the field. The cattle warily eyed the opening and rushed past it, refusing to go through.
Maybe they realize they're leaving home.
They don't realize nothing. They're just acting like cattle.
Huey rode up to the gate and pulled it shut, then casually dropped it to leave only a narrow opening. He rode Biscuit back to where the boys waited, holding the cattle in check.
Let's ride off the little boys and give them air.
They retreated 50 yards and watched. Presently, a couple of the more curious yearlings worked their way cautiously to the gate, sniffing at it, looking around in suspicion. One of them lifted its tail and half ran, half pitched through the opening. The second did the same, and the others followed suit.
All it takes to be a good cowboy is to be a little smarter than the cow brute. Let them think they're sneaking out, and you can put them any place.
By the time the yearlings reached the field, the teamsters were finished loading the wagons. The cattle hungrily scattered through the fresh stubble, enjoying a luxury to which they would never be able to become accustomed in this part of the country. Tommy looked toward Huey with concern about the cattle scattering.
Let them fill up. It's a long ways to Midland.
The feed was stacked high on the wagons. Huey entertained some fears that it might be top-heavy enough to tip over in a little visitation of bad luck, but he had to trust Hannigan's judgment. The big man had probably followed mules far enough to make 5 or 6 trips around the world if all his traveling could have been put together in one straight line. Huey rode up to Blue and shook his hand.
Blue, I wished I could tell you how I appreciate this.
I wish you'd learn when to shut up.
Blue looked across the newly cut field at the scattered yearlings.
You're gonna follow us with them cattle, ain't you? It's bad enough looking a set of mules in the rear.
Every man to his own brand of whiskey. We'll follow you.
Hannigan climbed up onto his wooden seat and uncoiled a long black snake whip. He circled it once over his head, then popped it behind him and again in front of him. The mules leaned into the collars and started Hannigan's pair of wagons into a slow, protesting movement. He hadn't touched any of them with the whip, but they knew from past experience that he could. He could not only lift the hair from any mule of his choice, but could pick the spot where the snake would strike. Huey and his nephews slowly and patiently coaxed the yearlings out of the stubble and back onto the kind of pasture land they were used to. They followed in the wake of the wagons, Huey riding point a while to set the pace. More than once, he turned in the saddle to look behind him. He half expected to see that marshal trailing him. But in all probability, the lawman was not going to feel like sitting in a saddle or anything else for 3 or 4 days. Huey rode Biscuit back to the boys.
When you got grandchildren, you can tell them you made one of the last great trail drives north. You don't have to tell them you was following a shirt-tail set of spotted yearlings and a string of freight wagons loaded with bundle feed.
Tommy squared himself in the saddle, pleased by the concept. Cotton didn't seem overly impressed. They watered the cattle at the windmill bearing Huey's name. He climbed most of the way to the top, surveying their back trail and looking across country toward Alvin Laudermilk's. He saw no one. Even if the officer did show up and carry Huey away now, it wouldn't ruin things for Walter and Eve. Blue Hannigan would handle the sale of the feed, and he would take it upon himself to look over the boys' shoulders to be sure they weren't cheated in selling the yearlings. From here on, if Cotton and Tommy had to, they could handle the situation without Huey. He had met his responsibilities. He climbed down the wooden ladder and dropped the last long step to the ground, resolving to waste no more of his energy worrying about the marshal and the New Prosperity jail. Those were problems for another day. He glanced up once more at the mill tower.
Damn, I wish that thing was painted.
The trip took 3 days. 3 days in which Huey knew once more the joy of being on the move, of riding free, good camaraderie, of being without a heavy burden of worry and guilt. His old humor came back to him. For 3 days, he regaled Tommy with outrageous stories of places he'd been, great jackpots he'd gotten into and out of, stories of the wide open country of blessed memory when there were no barbed wire fences and improved roads, no poverty farms checkerboarding the broad seas of prairie grass like smallpox scars on the face of a beautiful woman. Tommy listened with enthusiasm, if not total belief. Sometimes Huey wished the boy had been born earlier so he could have seen all these things for himself rather than have to share them vicariously with an uncle whose selective memory helped him recall the smiling times and pass over the dark as if they'd never been. Cotton listened with easy tolerance, but without Tommy's occasional open awe. Slowly, as Huey watched these two boys, it came to him how different they truly were. Cotton talked of the future as a time of automobiles and great machines and fantastic inventions waiting to burst forth upon the world. Huey shuddered. He tried, but he could picture no place in such a world for him. The wonders that made the future look golden to Cotton made it bleak and terrifying to Huey. Tommy showed no anxiety about those mysterious times ahead. Yet he still had a lively interest in the times already gone. Huey suspected that Tommy would probably make his life right here in this country of his youth. If Walter and Eve could weather the rough years and save what they had acquired, Tommy would be the one to carry it forward, to build on it, and keep the Callaway name alive on this land. He had the adaptability, Huey thought, to accommodate to the changes the Cottons would bring upon him. But he would always have roots deeply implanted in the traditions of the past. He would be one of those men blessed with the ability to save what was good of his heritage without slipping hopelessly behind the pace of his own times. In his way, Tommy would never grow so old that he would not somehow need his Uncle Huey, even when Huey was no more than a distant memory. But Cotton had already outgrown him. Cotton needed and wanted little from what had gone by. His gaze was fixed on the future. To him, the past was a ladder already climbed, to be left behind without regret, without nostalgia. Sadness came over Huey, along with this gradual realization. Cotton already had all he would ever need from Huey, a searching mind, a lively interest in things unseen. This, and the Callaway name, was all they really shared anymore. Huey had his memories of a closeness that once had been. He would have to settle for that. He would have to let go of Cotton, as Cotton had already let go of him. He felt a strong need to pull up beside Cotton and hug him once before he was gone forever. But he didn't do it, for Cotton wouldn't understand. It was too late to say goodbye, for the boy was already gone. In his place was a man for whom time started, not ended, with the year 06. Huey swung the little herd away from the wagons as they approached Midland from the south. No one needed to know, until the feed was sold and the money in hand, that any connection existed between Huey Callaway and Blue Hannigan. Blue waved as he started his wagons up the grade that led across the Texas and Pacific Railroad tracks and into the town that looked like a forest of wooden-towered windmills. Huey hunted around for a likely-looking patch of good green grass on which no other cattle seemed to have any immediate claim. He found one little way east up the tracks and far enough back that a passing train wouldn't throw the yearlings into a panic. They had never seen anything bigger than a freight wagon or heard anything, man or machine, with a voice louder than Blue Hannigan's. Huey told the boys to stay and loose herd the cattle, letting them graze while he went into town and scouted the market. Midland was a moderately bustling railroad and cow town, a supply center not only for the outlying ranches but for a dozen or more small and speculative towns which lay back off the railroad and which had only a tenuous claim on existence. Many of their names had been penciled onto maps for easy erasure in case they lost that claim. Some already had. More still would. This was a time of quick land promotions, quick disappointments, of boom today and bust tomorrow. Huey spotted a black automobile parked among a dozen farm wagons and knew Cotton would enjoy his stay here. Damn contraptions. Seemed like a man ran into one of them everywhere he turned anymore. Next thing, people would want to ride to the outhouse in an automobile and save walking from the back door. He visited two saloons and invested in two shots of whiskey while he plied the denizens about the cattle market. For about a dollar's expenditure on liquor of uncertain quality, he learned what he could logically expect to get for the yearlings. He then visited two local butcher shops and set up a time for the butchers to ride out and bid him for what they needed. Not both at the same time, of course. He knew they would want only the fleshier of the cattle, usually heifers. For the rest, he visited a cattle trader whose occupation it was to ride around the country picking up small numbers of cattle from farmers and little ranch operators, putting them together until he had a boxcar load or two. Then he shipped them to the Fort Worth market and hoped he could sell the whole lot for more money than he'd invested in them. Usually he managed to do so, or he would long since have gone back to working for wages. Huey set it up for him to come out to the herd after the butchers had finished and gone. Thus it was that before the day was done, Huey had split the little herd three ways and held the money in hand for all of it. As the trader and a kid helper started drifting the yearlings toward holding pens on the tracks, Huey made sure the roll of greenbacks was safely stowed in the bottom of his deepest pocket.
Boys, I'll set you both up to an ice cream.
As he expected, the sight of the automobile meant more to Cotton than all the ice cream in town. Huey watched him, reading the wanting in his nephew's face. It was all Cotton could do to keep from lifting the hood and getting in where the motor was. It would be futile to try to make a farmer or a cowboy out of Cotton. He knew how, but his heart was not in it, and it never would be. Tommy saw all he needed in 2 minutes, and he was ready for the ice cream.
If he doesn't come on, Uncle Huey, we ought to go without him.
Huey shook his head.
Let him be. Your brother knows what's important to him.
When Cotton finally did come along, he told them more than Huey really cared to know about the automobile, who had built it, how it operated, and what service could be expected of it.
It'd be fun if that feller had a breakdown right here in the street. I'll bet I could fix it.
I'm glad you don't have ambitions to be a doctor. You'll be wanting me to fall down sick so you could poke at me with a pocket knife.
He found an ice cream parlor and left the nephews there for safekeeping. He mounted Biscuit and rode to the Springer wagon yard Blue Hannigan frequented when he put in at Midland. Blue was turning his mules loose in a pen that Springer assigned to him, or more likely, Blue simply claimed by being there first. Blue's wagons were empty. So were the wagons of the other freighters. Huey grinned. It was a relief to see the wagons shed of their loads. Blue forked hay into wooden racks while a swamper spread oats into the long open troughs beneath. Blue finally laid down the fork and walked to where Huey leaned patiently against the fence.
Any trouble?
They asked me where the feed come from. I just said, south of town. They didn't ask how far south, and I didn't say. They acted real glad to get it.
Blue reached into his pocket and brought forth a leather wallet. Inside was a sheaf of bills greener than a barn full of alfalfa hay.
They offered to pay with a bank draft, but I told them they was dealing with a man who couldn't read nothing but numbers on a greenback.
Huey rifled the bills and tried to add them in his head. He feared the first time that he had made an error. A recount showed he had more money than he could rightfully have expected from the ranchers who normally bought from Walter.
Blue, you sure you didn't get some of your own money mixed up in this?
I've been known to make a mistake or two with a mule, but I never make a mistake with my money.
Fat Gervin was paying more for feed here at Midland than he had contracted to sell it for to the ranchers down south. The other teamsters, finished with their feeding, began to gather round. Huey's spirit soared as he stuck the roll into his pocket to keep company with that which he received for the cattle.
Me and Walter, that is. We owe you all something for making that haul. I'd sure like to pay you.
Blue made an exaggerated gesture of putting one hand behind his ear as if deaf.
I don't hear a word you say, Huey.
Huey's throat seemed to swell shut. None of these men had any intention of taking money. They did it for friendship, a commodity beyond price.
I reckon I've eaten too much dust. A drink of good whiskey might be just secure. I'd be tickled to set you fellas up to a round.
Funny how my hearing's all of a sudden come back to me.
With all that new wealth in his pockets, Huey felt able to give the boys a dollar apiece to spend any way they saw fit. He turned them loose to seek their own entertainment. He figured if two boys couldn't have a night's fun on a dollar per head, they weren't trying very hard. The only requirement he made was that they show up at the wagon yard by sunup, because that was when he planned to start south. Eve would probably raise hell when she found out, but she couldn't keep the boys under her thumb forever. As it turned out, both were in their bedrolls asleep long before Huey got through drinking a pint or two with Blue and the other freighters at the wagon yard. As Huey finally started to leave the saloon, Blue caught hold of his arm.
I've got a load of freight to take north off of the railroad. You wouldn't guess in a month what it is.
Huey didn't try.
It's gasoline to power them horseless carriages. Seems like just about every little town has got at least one or two of them little stinky things anymore. Funny, ain't it? People say them glorified spit cans is gonna replace the horse, but without the horse or mule to haul gasoline to them, they can't run a lick. The more them things they get, the more horses and mules this country is gonna need. You ought to take up freighting, Huey, while you can get in on the ground floor. There ain't nothing gonna take the place of a good stout freight wagon.
Huey, Cotton, and Tommy set out south before good daylight. A trip that took them 3 days with the wagons and the cattle could be done in 1 day by men a horseback, moving in a good steady trot. Biscuit was by instinct a pace setter, not a follower. The boys' horses had no choice but to keep up. Huey intended to reach Upton City while the bank was open because he itched to get this money out of his pockets and the note paid. He pushed hard. He sent the boys home when he was close enough and took out across country to shortcut the wagon road's meanderings. By afternoon, he rode into the lower end of Upton City's dirt street. He didn't think much of it when barber Orville Mulkey waved at him and then set out following him up the street. But in a minute, he looked back and saw half a dozen or more men walking along beside the barber. Somebody saw him coming and ran to the Dutchman's saloon.
Dutch! Huey's back!
Huey saw 5 men come out, one of them Schneider. They stood watching as he rode by, then fell in with the procession. Pearson Phelps left his store and joined the parade. Huey looked back uncertainly, suddenly nervous. Ahead of him at the courthouse, Big Sheriff Wes Wheeler walked down the steps and strode casually out to meet him, nodding a silent greeting. Huey reined up, glanced back, then looked at the sheriff.
Wes, if I'm in trouble...
Wheeler was not much given to smiling.
If you are, Huey, looks like you'll have a flock of reliable witnesses.
These men were friends, or at least acquaintances. He saw no hostility anywhere and knew no reason there should be, unless that new prosperity marshal had been spreading lies about him. Nervously, he wiped a sleeve across his mouth, waiting for somebody to say something. Nobody did. He tugged at the reins gently and set Biscuit into a walk, crossing the street to the front of the little stone bank. The front door, set crossways on a blunted corner, was still open. Huey looked once more at the crowd who had followed him afoot. There had to be 16 or 18 of them now, not counting Wes Wheeler. Wes was big enough for 2 men all by himself. Huey licked dry lips.
Howdy, fellas.
All he got was grins and silence. He reined in Biscuit and swung out of the saddle, wrapped the reins around a hitching post, and stepped up into the bank. His gaze fastened immediately upon Fat Girvin, sitting at a roll-top desk behind the stockade-like fence through which the sheep and the goats were customarily separated before they ever reached him for an audience. The look in Fat's florid face was of sullen dismay.
I come to see you, Fat.
Fat said nothing. He only stared.
You got a note here against my brother Walter. I come to settle up with you.
Fat still said nothing. A young man who had been hired out of a Fort Worth mercantile company as a bank clerk pulled a file drawer from a heavy oak cabinet and rummaged through the papers. He withdrew one and laid it in front of Fat.
This is the one, Mr. Girvin.
Fat flared, resenting his mixing in, then stared down at the paper. Huey pulled the rolls of greenbacks out of his pocket and fanned them. He piled them one at a time on the corner of Fat's desk. Huey knew to the penny what Walter owed. He had lain awake nights, adding it up in his mind. He finished building his pile of the feed and cattle money and what he earned from Alvin Laudermilk, then looked Fat square in the eye.
I got authority to draw on Walter's account for what else is due. You tally it up and write the draft, Fat.
Face a deep red... Girvin dipped a pen into an inkwell and wrote out a check. He turned it slowly and shoved it roughly toward Huey. Huey took the pen from Fat's stubby fingers, made a long flourish, and signed his name.
Now I'll thank you for a receipt in handwriting.
Fat Girvin seemed to shrink, to draw inward, shutting all of them out. A thin, bent-shouldered old man pushed through the festive onlookers with some anxiety. Huey blew on the receipt, trying to rush the drying of the ink.
What the hell's going on here? You had a bank robbery?
Same thing, CC. Only just the opposite. I handed off a robbery by a bank. I paid off Walter's note.
CC stared at him in momentary disbelief until a look at Fat's sullen face disabused him of doubt. CeCe's disappointment was keen and painful, but he made a gallant effort at covering it up. Nobody could accuse CeCe Tarpley of being a sore loser. Well, not a very sore loser.
That's fine, Huey. Tell you the truth, I never thought you could do it.
I know. In fact, I remember a little pledge you made.
He shifted his gaze to Fat, who remembered it very well also.
I intended to hold you to it, Fat, but I'm a generous feller at heart. I'll let you off because I don't want to take my britches down in front of a crowd like this.
Somehow the crowd all seemed to know about CeCe's pledge. CeCe regarded his son-in-law without any fondness. In his face was a look that said he wouldn't care if Huey demanded full payment.
I know what Fat done to you about your yearlings and your feed. I would have to figure you found a buyer for your cattle anyway. But what the hell did you do with all that feed?
I found buyers for that, too.
Who?
Huey let his grin break wide open, warm and bright.
You and Fat?
The old man's face reddened as realization soaked in.
For how much?
Huey wrote the number and handed it to CeCe. CeCe Tarpley's anger built slowly, like water coming to a boil in a chuckwagon coffee pot. Finally, it would hold no longer. He ripped off his dusty old felt hat. He began to beat Fat about the head and shoulders with it while Fat cringed and tried to cover his face with his arms. Huey stepped out the front door of the bank and sought out Dutch Schneider.
Dutch, I'm going to set up one round of drinks for this bunch. After that, I'm saving my money.
Huey felt ambivalent about the Laudermilk place. Spring Renfro lingered much on his mind. He itched to see her. But she wouldn't be the only person waiting for him there. He dreaded facing that marshal from New Prosperity, whose prickly pear wounds, if not yet healed, should at least have reached a point of toleration. Somebody must have seen him coming, for when he rode up to the ranch house, Spring, the Laudermilks, old Lady Faversham, and Julio all stood on the porch waiting for him. The old lady was on her cane. Spring ran down the steps to meet him at the gate. She was no longer shy about showing her feelings in front of people. She threw her arms around him. Huey hadn't realized a small-built woman could be so strong. She kissed him and didn't seem to care whether old Lady Faversham watched or not.
Did everything go all right, Huey?
Like a brand-new Ingersoll watch. You ought to have seen Fat Gervin's face when I paid him off.
I wish I could have been there. Have you told Eve and Walter?
No. I'll have to let you go tell him for me. I came to give myself up to that marshal. You all get all the stickers out of him?
That was a private matter between him and Alvin and Julio. I think they left a few where they thought they would do the most good.
Well, it won't do me any good. Where's he at?
Alvin came down from the porch.
He's halfway back to New Prosperity, I imagine. He decided they needed him at home more than he needed you.
Huey turned, not quite believing.
What did you do to him?
Alvin held up his hands. He was the personification of purity and innocence.
Not a thing. Never laid a hand on him except to pull pear thorns, but, I had Wes Wheeler come out and explain a few things to him about law in our part of the country. Like when he made you pull the steeples out of my fence. Now that was willful destruction of private property. And, then there was a matter of my plow horse that he made you ride. Horse theft, pure and simple. I've had Wes explain it to him how narrow-minded we are about such as that. Then I just happened to mention to him that if he would drop his charges against you, I'd try my best to talk Wes into tearing up the charges I had sworn out against him. And he got to acting kind of homesick all of a sudden.
If Preacher Averill had been there, Huey would gladly have made a contribution to the church. He squeezed Alvin's hand so hard that the old horseman flinched.
Alvin, I'll owe you as long as I live.
Alvin shook his head. Wistfully, he studied Huey's face.
You done proud for yourself.
Alvin looked at Spring, then back to Huey.
You know, I like the old Huey an awful lot, and I hate to lose him. But I reckon I'll get used to the new Huey by and by. He's a pretty good old boy himself.
Julio saddled Spring's paint horse for her so she could ride to Walter's and Eve's with Huey. Huey turned and waved at the family as he rode away. Alvin and old Lady Faversham looked sad. But Cora was smiling, and so was Julio. A romantic to the end.
I don't suppose you'd want to make a little circle by the Barcroft place on the way?
Huey hunched a little, finding no joy in the thought.
Well, tomorrow maybe. Right now I'm anxious to turn this receipt over to Walter and Eve.
She gave him a worried glance, but said nothing. The sun was going down as they approached the Calloway house. Huey could feel how tired Biscuit was. The steps were labored and slow, for it had been a long, long day. It was seldom that he ever pushed a horse so hard. As at the Laudermilk place, they had evidently been seen. Everyone stood in front of the house, waiting for them. Walter leaned on his crutches, his face expectant. Eve was trying to smile confidently, but Huey had disappointed her many times before. The anxiety showed in her eyes. Huey stepped down from a grateful horse, which was almost trembling from fatigue. He turned to help spring to the ground.
Here we go.
Huey stood with his left arm around her while he fished in his shirt pocket for the signed receipt. He brought it out, extended it toward Eve, and grinned broadly. Hands shaking, she unfolded it, glanced at it, handed it to Walter, and threw her arms around Huey's neck.
Oh, Huey!
She hugged him as tightly as spring had done at the Laudermilks, but for a much different reason. She stood back, her eyes brimming with tears.
Huey Calloway, there have been times I've said hard things to you in anger, and most of them were justified. But right now, I take back every word. Every word.
Then the four of them were standing with their arms around each other. The two boys stood off to the side, watching, smiling. Tommy turning sheepishly to wipe his sleeve across his eyes.
Huey, I wished I knew how to...
You got a lot to thank them boys for. Without them, it wouldn't have got done.
The boys know how I feel, how me and Eve both feel.
Walter crumpled the receipt.
We still got a hard row ahead of us, but we've taken the roughest of it. We're gonna make it from here on.
Damn right you'll make it.
Eve wiped her eyes and turned toward the door.
Let's get into the house. We'll have supper directly.
Huey started toward the horses, but Eve caught his arm.
The boys can turn the horses loose. You come on in this house.
Huey poured coffee for Spring and himself. Spring put sugar in hers, but Huey liked his coffee the way he liked his whiskey, straight. He stood at the window, looking out toward the barn. Eve couldn't get through thanking him. She put her arms around Huey again.
Huey Calloway, you just don't know.
She leaned her forehead against his shoulder.
If there's ever anything me and Walter can do for you, anything you ever need...
Huey shook his head.
Eve, you don't owe me a thing. I owed you, and I done what I could to pay. I don't want a thing.
His gaze fell upon Cotton, pulling the saddle off of Biscuit. He watched thoughtfully.
I take it back, Eve. There is something.
Anything we've got, it's yours.
Eve, you may not like the price.
We'll pay it.
He pointed his chin at the window and looked back at the boy by the barn.
Let Cotton go.
Huey, I couldn't do that.
You'll have to sooner or later. Do it now, while he knows what he wants and has a real chance to go and get it. Eve, it's been 6 years since we came into the new century. We still belong to the old one, me and you and Walter. We always will. But there's a different road in front of Cotton. One day he'll pick up and follow it whether you let him go or not. Let him go now, with no hard feelings to pain him when he looks back.
Eve turned to Walter.
Eve, he was right. Cotton's come to his time.
My boy, my Cotton.
Eve fished in her apron pocket, but didn't find what she was looking for. Spring gave her a handkerchief. Eve used it, then wadded it in her hands.
It's a scary world out yonder that you're asking me to send him off into. I don't understand half of what I hear or read about it.
Us three, we never will. We was born too soon. But Cotton will make himself a place in it. Eve, we don't have to understand it. All we have to know is that he'll be all right.
Eve didn't answer. She hadn't made up her mind to it yet, but she would. Tomorrow, the next day, one day soon, she would. She turned to the stove to busy her hands and perhaps thereby busy her mind on something else. From behind, Spring put her arms around Huey and laid her head against his back.
Thank you, Huey. Forgotten.
Eve said the blessing at the supper table, and it was such a long one, Huey was afraid the food would get cold. She had a lot to thank the Lord for, and he couldn't think of a thing she overlooked. In the last little while, the realization began to come upon Huey with some force that he hadn't eaten anything all day. It was an experience not unknown to a drifting man, but one to be avoided whenever possible. He was into his second helping of red frijole beans and cornbread when he heard a commotion outside. It sounded like a bunch of horses running. He pushed his chair back and went to the window.
I'll be damned.
You probably will be using language like that. What's the matter out there?
Huey pointed his chin, smiling.
Well, look who's coming.
Huey walked quickly out into the yard and hurried toward the corral. From the west, like phantoms out of the dusk, came a remuda of horses in a hard trot, heading for a gate someone had loped ahead and opened for them. Snort Yarnell swung back into the saddle and pulled off to one side to give them room. The horses raised a gray cloud of dust as they rushed through the opening. Huey climbed over the fence and grasped the wooden gate, pushing it shut as Snort rode his blue roan in behind the string of young horses.
Swan, Snort, you're like a bad penny. Where'd you come from this time?
From the KCs, like I told you. Went out there to pick me up a string of horses to take back over onto the concho. I wonder if Walter would mind me keeping them in the corral here tonight.
Snort knew very well that Walter would let him. Few people would turn away a stranger, much less an old friend.
Well, unsaddle and come up to the house. We're in the middle of supper. There's a plenty.
Yeah, I've been counting on that.
The rewards of the day had been so great that even Eve had a nice welcome for Snort. Spring stood back away from him a little, eyeing him with reserve, even a touch of fear. Tommy kept wanting to bring things from the stove for Snort, and when Snort had more spread in front of him than he was likely to be able to eat, Tommy beamed.
I'll go out and feed your horses, Snort.
Not too much, boy.
Snort pointed a fork at him.
These is wild ranch horses, and they're like wild ranch men, used to doing for themselves. We don't want to be spoiling them none.
The kitchen fell silent except for the clinking of Snort's utensils on his plate. That man could put away a fearsome amount of food when he set himself to it. But finally, he pushed his chair away from the table and rocked back on its two hind legs. Snort glanced from Huey to Spring.
This good lady got the knot tied on you yet, Huey?
Spring looked at the floor.
Well, not yet.
Well, when are you all going to commit the deed?
Huey rubbed his hands together.
I don't know. We ain't really talked about that.
You ain't any great rush, Huey?
Rush?
I was thinking if you all wasn't in any real big hurry, you might like to go off on a little trip with me. Last bachelor trip, you might say.
Huey's interest began to pick up.
Trip? Where to?
Old Mexico. I got a job lined up down there with an American outfit, as soon as I get these here horses delivered. They said if I found any more good cowboys that wanted a job, just to bring them on along. Got a winter's work, at least. Maybe on into next year, too.
Huey's pulse began to pound at the thought of it. Mexico. Snort leaned over the table.
It ain't just on that Penny Ante border, Huey. It's way down yonder, way down deep. Beautiful country. Not spoiled like this country's getting to be, but big and wild and wide open. It's like Texas was before they commenced putting fences across it and cutting it up for farming. It's like going back to when we was young. I think me and you ought to see that just one more time while there's still a little bit of it left.
Huey felt a hand gently touch his arm. He saw Spring staring at him, her eyes pinched with pain.
Mr. Yarnell, I believe Tommy is having some trouble down at the pens. I believe some of your horses are trying to get out.
Snort jumped to his feet and hurried out the door.
Huey, don't you listen to him. It's the devil that brought him here.
I wasn't listening. I mean, I was listening, but I wasn't really studying on going.
Spring reached up and put her fingers under his chin, turning him to face her. He saw tears in her eyes.
You would like to go, wouldn't you?
Why, you oughtn't to pay any attention to Snort Yarnell. It's always a beautiful country if he's never been there. He's fiddle-footed, just like I used to be.
Used to be?
Spring tried hard to smile, but she couldn't bring it out.
Huey, I can see it in your eyes. I saw it at the Barcroft place. I saw it when Snort was by here the last time. But I tried to tell myself I was wrong. I tried to tell myself you changed. You haven't changed. You never will.
He wanted to say something to convince her she was wrong, but no words presented themselves. Nothing came because he knew she was right.
Spring.
She touched her fingers against his lips to stop him from trying to speak, to argue.
There was never anything false about you, Huey. I loved you for being just what you were. You were happy, and I felt happy just being around you. But lately, I've watched you trying very hard to be something else. Somebody else. You've been miserable, and I've hurt for you. If I marry you, you can't stay the same as you've always been. You'll have to change for me. And when you change, you won't be Huey anymore. Some things we just can't have, because if we try to hold them, they die. There's no way I can have you without changing you. So go ahead, Huey. Go with Snort. I know it's what you really want to do deep in your heart. Go on, then. Go on to Mexico.
Huey took her hand and gripped it tightly in both of his own.
I do love you, Spring. You know that.
I know. But I know you love freedom even more.
Spring, are you sure you won't regret this?
Certainly I'll regret it. I'll regret it 1,000 times. But I'll always know I was right.
Spring, you don't know what you're saying. Let him go down there and you'll never see him again. We may none of us ever see him again. Like as not, he'll wind up dead someplace under an outlaw horse.
Tears welled up in Spring's eyes and spilled down her cheeks.
Elvin knew all along. He said Huey is a free spirit, like an eagle. I can't bring myself to put an eagle in a cage.
Daylight, Snort Yarnell opened the gates and strung the horses out eastward into the pink glow that came just ahead of the sun. He put them into a long, mile-eating trot. Snort looked back once for Huey, then went ahead. Huey stood halfway between the house and the barn, leather reins in his hand. Biscuit waiting, saddled and patient behind him. The family stood lined up to see him away. Spring Renfro waited alone, a little to one side. Huey extended his hand, and Walter leaned forward on his crutches to take it.
Walter, you're going to make it. You and Tommy, you'll build yourselves a place here better than anything old CC ever had.
It's always part yours, Huey.
No, Walter. A piece of land is for those who will root down on it. You know me.
Huey moved to Eve. She couldn't talk. She put her arms around him and said in that way all there was to say. He moved down to Cotton.
Boy, you really think them automobiles are gonna put us old cowboys out of business?
In time, Uncle Huey. In time.
Huey gripped his nephew's shoulder.
Well, you go out there and give them all you've got. But just remember, me and old Biscuit, we ain't gonna lay down easy.
Tears had cut a trail down Tommy's face. He put his arms around Huey's neck and hugged hard.
You'll be back, won't you, Uncle Huey? You ain't gonna let some bronc kill you.
Button. I ain't never been killed in my life.
He turned finally to Spring. He saw her through a haze because his eyes were burning. He tried to speak to her, but his throat had swollen suddenly. He put his arms around her and pulled her against him, and he felt the warm strength of her arms against his shoulders. She said nothing either.
Huey!
Reluctantly, Huey let Spring go and stepped back. She lowered her head, trying to hide her eyes. Gently, he put his fingers under her chin and raised her head a little. He winked at her, though doing so squeezed out a tear that tickled as it ran down his cheek. He gave her a half smile and got one from her in return. Huey turned quickly. He shoved his boot into the stirrup and swung up onto the snakeskin-covered saddle. Biscuit was rested and raring to go. Huey touched him very lightly with the spurs. Biscuit set out in a trot to catch the horses. Huey turned once, reined up, and waved his hat. Then he rode on. The sun broke over the prairie in a sudden red blaze. The family all pulled together, arms around each other, Spring standing to one side, still alone. They watched as Huey seemed to ride into the fire, sitting straight-shouldered and proud on Biscuit's back. Finally, he was gone, melted into the relentless glow of a new day. Huey Calloway, The Good Old Boys is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1985, Elmer Kelton. Published by arrangement with Elmer Kelton, care of Sobel Weber Associates, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Dylan Lynch, Tim Carlin, Christopher Graybill, Michael Glenn, Christopher Sheeran, Catherine Aselford, Yasmin Toison, Joe Brack, Eric Messner, Ken Jackson, Richard Rowan, Sherry Simpson, James Konacek, Michael John Casey, Lily Beacon, Thomas Keegan, Nanette Savard, Tom Simpson, Drew Kopas, Bobby Aselford, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. With original music by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Huey Calloway, be sure to look for Elmer Kelton's Texas Rangers series. Available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in graphic audio.
There's two banks in Dodge City. Both are full of cattlemen's money, according to what I've heard. We hit them both, hard and fast, right after they open. Make examples out of them that tries to fight back. Gun them down like ducks coming off a pond.
I hear Dodge can be a tough town, Bill. Maybe you hadn't ought to figure that'll be that easy.
You done turned yellow dog on us, Curly. I got no use for a damn coward.
You ain't gonna shoot me, Bill.
You ain't left me no choice, Kirk. I gotta make an example out of you.
We've been together since...
Any more you sons of bitches got anything to say?
My name's Wyatt Earp. I'm the city marshal. Just curious as to why you're carrying so many guns at this hour.
Smoke Jensen. I was headed down to check on a herd I brought in yesterday. As to the guns, I rarely go anywhere without them. Old habit, I reckon.
It's called fate. Some men have got the fates dead set against them. Smoke is one. Most other men can ride all the way from California to Dodge City without having so much as a loose horseshoe. Smoke don't hardly ever get that kind of peace. It's the hand of fate that keeps guiding them toward the fight.
Welcome to Dodge, Mr. Bloody Bill Anderson. We've got a little surprise waiting for you.
Saddle up and ride into adventure with Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man 22. Pride of the Mountain Man. Available now in graphic audio.
Tell me, Kip, if you've done bad things your whole life, but you die doing something good, do you think that makes up for all the bad?
No.
Me neither.
But it's better than nothing. Orholam is merciful.
Wonder if you'll say that after they're done with your village.
Gavin Guile is the Prism, the most powerful man in the world. He is High Priest and Emperor, a man whose power, wit, and charm are all that preserves a tenuous peace. A peace that is slowly rotting from the inside out.
This is all that's left of what was once a great civilization. Statues of great men, broken by the pygmies who followed. Let me tell you something you already know. something that all of you have believed, but no one dared to say. The wrong Guile won the Prism's war. They killed him because they were worried he would change everything. They feared him because Dazen Guile wanted to free us. Dazen knew that light cannot be changed.
As darkness slowly encroaches upon the land, Gavin receives a mysterious letter.
Undying Gavin, it's time you meet your son Kip, Lena.
As Gavin races to find his son, he learns of a new and dangerous threat to his empire. A man who calls himself King.
Your time is finished. Yours and the Chromaria's. You're done! Light cannot be chained. Know this, Prism. We will take back what you've stolen. The horrors of your reign are almost at an end. And when it ends, I will be there. This I swear!
With the death of his empire looming, Gavin will be forced to wage a war on multiple fronts. But little does he know, his assassin may be looking right before his very eyes.
You're a stupid, stupid boy, Kip. But maybe a dull sword can go where a sharp one wouldn't be allowed. Don't you forget this. Don't listen to him, you hear me? He's a liar. You will not fail me in this, Kip. You learn, and then you kill him.
Yes, Mother?
Kip, if you ever loved me, avenge me. Swear it by your worthless soul, Kip.
I swear to avenge you, Mother, by my very soul.
Don't miss the beginning of the end in Brent Week's critically acclaimed new series, The Lightbringer Trilogy. Book 1, The Black Prism, Parts 1 through 3. Available now in graphic audio.
Are you laughing?
Yeah, I was laughing.
At what?
At the madness, Natalia, the sheer madness. We've been at this same war, essentially, for 625 years, and we've come full circle. But the irony of it all is that the nuclear weapons which once destroyed the planet are now the only things which might save the planet. But if we use them to save the planet, we stand a very real chance of losing the war and all we fought for.
The final countdown has begun. The epic confrontation between good and evil is about to be waged.
I don't like it. He's too good, Father.
You worry too much, Mark. This is all part of a plan I have refined over many years in waiting. We will realize the dream of Alexander and Caesar and Hitler. Be sole masters of the planet.
Such a prize is worth such a risk.
But Dietrich Zimmer's evil knows no bounds. With his mastery of medical technology, he implants a false memory in Sarah Rourke's mind.
John Rourke led a life that will be perceived by everyone as a life dedicated to helping mankind. It should be left at that. With your father dead, Michael, the truth will never have to come out.
The truth? The truth? What the hell is the truth, Sarah? Come on. You know something we don't, you're saying? What?
I know what really happened the night the Nazis attacked the hospital at Eden City. And none of the rest of you do. I know who pointed the gun at my head and pulled the trigger.
With Zimmer's lies polluting all she can see, Sarah Rourke will be forced to commit the ultimate atrocity.
This is Paul Rubenstein! Full cardiac team to Commander Shaw's cabin on the double! John Rourke may be dead!
Don't miss the cataclysmic action in the epic buildup to the final survivalist.
The good guy always wins. It may seem as though evil is victorious at times, but in the end, evil will always fail, and right will eventually prevail. There can be no other way.
Survivalist number 26, Countdown. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.